The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is an interesting series of portions that we're in the middle of. First of all, I want to thank you all for calling in. And we've had a little bit of a hiatus between being away and trips and whatnot. So it's nice to be back. We got a few weeks of in-country Teletara. And these three portions, sort of Shmot Va'era, really Bo, a little B'Shalach, this coming week of Bo, deals with sort of the plagues and the exodus from Egypt. And what's interesting is that because we so often focus on the scope of 10 plagues, we don't always get a chance to take a look at any particular individual plague. And of all the 10 plagues, you know, it's hard to say you have a pet plague, but the one that fascinates me the most is the plague of darkness. And the rabbis have a great difference of opinion as to how exactly this plague occurred and what it meant. And most fascinating is the perspective that somehow darkness existed alongside light. Now you can imagine that if we're going to do a Teletara, and if it's going to be an Israelite Teletara, this would be a natural topic for discussion. So I started thinking about this. You know, I was thinking that of all the experiences, at least that I've personally had, there's nothing that even comes close to the experience of darkness next to light, as does the particular afternoon that I found myself in the Sparrow's Pizzeria. You know, you have a moment which is such light that transforms itself into a moment of as pure darkness as you can imagine. And yet, in the middle of that darkness, you still see that there's such light. You know, you're sitting eating a big ziti. It's a beautiful Jerusalem afternoon. The front of the pizzeria is filled with families, children, ice cream, you know, just something out of a movie, you know? And in an instant, the entire world turns upside down. And fire and explosion, that there's a moment of silence that's as raw, as tangible a silence as you can imagine. If anybody here has ever been in a car accident, which I hope no one else will be, but there's an instant after a car accident, most probably because your senses are shocked to such a degree, and the transformation of movement and sound is so severe, there's a moment of pure silence after a car accident, before sort of reality sets in. One minute you're speeding along, or you're in traffic, and the next minute this tremendous bang, crash, and just shock. And in that shock is pure silence. The rabbis say that the darkness, Vayamesh Choshech, it says, there was a mamashut, there was a tangibility. It wasn't sort of just darkness that was the absence of light. There was a tangible nature to this darkness, whatever that means. And I remember this moment, it seemed like a moment of silence after the explosion went off. I don't know if it's because the air gets sucked out of the room. I don't know if it's because there's a moment of shock. You know, how many conversations are going on in a particular instant in a crowded pizzeria on an afternoon in the middle of the summer? And all of a sudden, in an instant, all the conversations stop. You know, and there's a moment of pure silence. And then everything, you know, light turns into darkness. And screaming and pain and death and just all that you can think of. And then people start to climb into the windows. There's a paramedic who shows up, who climbs inside against every instinct you could imagine. And all you want to do is get out of there, but there are people suffering, so you don't necessarily go right out of there. And then you not run back in there because there aren't enough ambulances. There was only one ambulance initially, and we're trying to ferry people out. And so you find that in the midst of darkness, there are moments of such pure light. You know, but I want to understand that. I saw, and I think, by the way, that part of this is not just what you experience, but maybe even how you choose to experience things. You know, somebody sent me a funny email, and if you want a copy of this, feel free to send me an email. I'll be glad to send it to you. But it's some, I don't know, some insurance company that is trying to tell people not to judge. You know, don't judge by what you see. So you can imagine that I'm saving this for some class on judging people meritoriously. But one of the particular scenes is that there's this doctor and what looks like an intern. And they're standing in a hospital room, and they're standing over a patient, sort of, I guess, they're doing rounds. And there's a fly. And the fly is annoying the doctor, right? And he keeps, like, sort of, you know, while he's talking and giving his diagnosis, he keeps sort of, you know, sort of putting up his hand to swat away the fly. And the intern notices that the doctor is annoyed by the fly and has a clever idea. He takes the paddles, you know, for the defibrillator off the wall, right? And he charges them. And he kind of waits until the fly is hovering in front of him, right? And then he gets ready to sort of shock the fly. And then it pans away to this mother and daughter who are coming up in an elevator, you know, such a sweet scene, holding flowers and chocolates. They're going to visit Daddy. Daddy is actually lying asleep on the bed beneath this hovering fly being diagnosed or reviewed by the doctor and the intern. And then you see the intern, and he sticks out the paddle, zzz, and he zaps the fly. And the dead fly falls on top of the patient. And just as the woman and her daughter walked in, right, the doctor looks at the intern, says, well, that killed him, right? And then the mother, kind of in shock, is seeing this intern with two electric paddles standing over her sleeping husband. Well, that killed him. And I guess everything depends on how you look at it, right? And that's when the ad ends. Right, it's all how you look at the world, right? So what is that? Now there's an interesting idea, okay, that all of these plagues, in addition to being part of a process, okay, that there's a gradual undermining of creation until nature is experiences a complete upheaval, right? You know, God creates a world. And nature is the vehicle or the illusion of the vehicle that runs the world that we exist in. But nature's a gift. And it's an opportunity to experience God in the world and to experience beauty in the world. And if nature becomes a vehicle for evil, if it becomes a source of power instead of a vehicle for good, then something's wrong. Right? So God creates the world and says, let there be light. And Egypt, an ancient society, sinks to such a level of evil that the source of light is no longer God, it's the Nile River. Right? God says, let there be light, which is Or in Hebrew. The Nile, the ancient Egyptians worshipped the Ye-Or. So God says, if you think that this is the source of all light, then you're missing the entire purpose of the world. Right? So the river turns to blood. And gradually, because nature has become the source of power and to be worshipped, instead of to be appreciated as a vehicle to relate them to God, gradually all of nature is undone. Fire and water mix. Vegetation is destroyed by locusts, etc. Right? And in this stage comes the plague of darkness. So what role does this plague play? And it stands to reason there's a given within the Torah that everything that comes in the Torah carries a message for the future. It's not just a description of some historical event. There are messages. We're meant to learn something forever. For every detail in the Torah, what am I meant to learn from the plague of darkness? So there's an interesting medrash, right? The medrash rabbinic legend, very interesting. The pasuk, the verse says, this is in the 10th chapter, right? Perek Yud, in the 22nd verse. Vayet Moshe et yado al hashamayim, and so Moshe sort of stretches out his hands. Now it should say towards the sky. It actually says on the sky, which is a difficult question. But of course, that raises the question of where the sky begins and the ground ends. If you think about what sky is, if you hold your hands directly out in front of you, right, and you're an ant sitting underneath those outstretched arms, To the ant, your hands are in the sky. But to you, your hands are below your eyesight, and therefore they're above the ground. Right? Where does the sky end? Is the centimeter above the ground already the sky? Well, if that's true, that means that I walk in the sky. So what does it mean that Moshe strikes his hand out on the sky? It should say above the land. Vayi choshech afela b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, and there is darkness. So on this verse, for 3 days in all the land of Egypt, right? So on this verse, the Midrash, in the Midrash Rabbah, this is the, I guess you could call it the rabbinic legend, right? Collection of rabbinic legends. So the Midrash, this is on the portion of Bo, right? It cites a very interesting debate. It's one of those debates like, you don't quite know how the rabbis got to this. It's almost like they must have had a slow afternoon, you know? So it says, Vayet Moshe et yado al ha-shamayim v'yi choshech ha-fela, and Moshe cast out his hand on the sky, and there was darkness. What choshech ha-fela means is a raw and intense darkness, a dark darkness. Mehechan ha-ya choshech ha-hu. So where did this darkness come from? Now, that's a very strange question. What do you mean, where did the darkness come from? The darkness doesn't come from anywhere. The darkness is always there, it's just that light is illuminating it, right? So, really, darkness doesn't come. Something else is removed. Right? If you're in a room, and 1 minute it's light, how do you get it to be dark? You don't bring darkness, you just remove light. So the Midrash is making a point here. Right? Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia. So Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nechemia have a debate. Rabbi Yehuda omer michoshech shel mala. This comes from the darkness of above. What does darkness of above mean? Strange phrase. Shenemar yeshet choshech sitro. Quotes a verse. Rabbi Nechemia amar michoshech shel gehinom, from the darkness of hell. Right, and brings a proof text from Eo, from the book of Job. So this is very interesting. First of all, what does it mean that Moshe stretches his hand out above the sky? Second of all, what's the nature, right? Where do Rabbi Nechemia and Rabbi Yehuda get their opinions? One saying that this darkness is from heaven, and the other saying, basically, that this darkness is from hell. Right? And go a stage further, by the way, how could two rabbis have such opposite opinions? Right? That's such a strange perception. How does one rabbi come to assume that the darkness is from heaven, and the other assume that the darkness is from hell? Right? And while we're at it, by the way, take a look at the next verse. Because the next verse is even more fascinating. U'lechol b'nei Yisrael haya or b'moshvotam. But all the Jews had light in their dwelling places. Now, I guess there are a couple things that are strange about that. First of all, if I'm enveloping darkness, right? If I'm rather taking darkness and inserting it, then it's not that the Jews have light, it's that the Jews don't have darkness. In fact, why does it say that the Jews had light? It should say that the Jews don't experience darkness. In fact, you see this in other plagues. For example, if you look in, where is this, 1 second? In chapter 9, in Perek Tet, verse 26, Pasuk Chavav, in describing the hail, it says, Rak be'eretz Goshen, asher sham b'nei Yisrael, only in the land of Goshen where the Jews were, lo haya barad, there was no hail. And that's what I've expected. Here comes the plague, but the Jews don't have this plague. But that's not what it says. It says that the Egyptians have darkness, and the Jews have light. So that's very different from saying that the Jews don't have darkness. So why is it expressed this way? So there's an amazing Tiferet Shmuel, which I once saw in a thought that Rabbi Abba Wegensberg had sent out from, I think he was teaching at Chappelle's, I'm not really sure, and I don't have it in front of me, I couldn't find it. But I recall more or less sort of, you know, what he quoted. And I did find the Gemara that he quoted. There's a Talmudic discussion in Nidarim, in the Tractate of Nidarim, which deals with oaths, but that's for another time. And that says a fascinating thing. This is on Dafchet, on the eighth folio, on the bottom of the second side of the page, Chet Amudbet, and it says like this. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Rav Shimon ben Lakish has something to say about a particular topic they're discussing. By the way, it's interesting to note that Rav Shimon ben Lakish, was a fascinating individual. He was originally called Ben Lakish, right? And that's because he was considered the greatest robber of his day. He was the master robber. And in those days, a robber was a euphemism also for a wicked person. And somehow, without going into the details of the story, he meets Rav Yochanan, right? And he's called Reish Lakish, and he completely turns his life around. And he becomes one of the great Torah sages. So if there's someone who understands the transformation from darkness to light, it's definitely Reish Lakish, right? Ben Lakish. Rav Shimon Ben Lakish. So he says, the Amar, Ein Gehinom Le'olam Haba. There is no hell. Now, what Gehenna is an interesting question. It's a little bit beyond the purview of this discussion. It's not really quite purgatory of the Catholic world, because purgatory is some sort of eternal damnation. Judaism does not believe in eternal damnation. There's no value to punishment or consequence that's eternal. If you don't learn from it and have the opportunity to grow, there's no value to it. It's like getting kicked out of the classroom forever. It doesn't do anything for you, right? So, in Judaism, Gehenna is some sort of a stage, right? It's a stage of perfection, of purification. It's some process that the soul needs to undergo that somehow didn't succeed in undergoing in this world. And since I haven't been there yet, hopefully I don't get there, but I haven't been there, so I can't really, fully, no one in this world can fully understand it. But that seems to be the general idea of what, Judaism's commentary is. So Rav Shimon Lakish says, no. Ein Gehinom Le'olam Haba. There's no hell, whatever Gehenna is, in the world to come. Rather, what does Hashem do? He takes the sun out of its encasing, out of its shield. And when the sun comes back to the purity that it once was, tzadikim mitrapin ba, then the righteous are healed by it. Verishaim nidonin ba. But the wicked are judged, which in this context means that they're punished. They suffer from it. And quotes a verse. In other words, the same sunlight that heals the righteous causes pain and suffering to the wicked. Right? And the Ran, Rabbi Nissim Gaon, who is one of the medieval commentaries here, actually points out, we're not talking about after death. We're not talking about, sort of when a person dies that there's no Gehenim. Tivadai ika geinom l'rashayim, because certainly the wicked experience, they have to somehow get fixed. There has to be some consequence, some process through which they undergo, otherwise there's no justice. We're talking about the future, one day when redemption comes, after the resurrection, whatever that means, definitely not for right now. Kedichtiv, and he quotes whatever, Daniel, etc., that there will come a time, right? Lo yunidonim begeinom, when one day when the future comes, people will not be judged, they will not be punished, or consequences will not occur in Gehenim, whatever that means. Ela b'hai dina, but in this fashion, Shagadosh b'chu, that Hashem removes the sun from its encasing, kidei, now listen to this line, kidei shi yu elu mitzta'arin v'yishlapu batzadikim, so that these, in other words, the wicked, can be sorry, right, can regret, with the same vehicle through which the righteous are cured. So what is that about? What exactly is that about? What does that mean? So the Tzfarat Shmuel says an amazing thing. It says, what does it mean that the sun comes out in this Talmudic discussion, and the wicked are punished by its light, and the tzaddikim are healed by it, right? So, if you think about it, if a person has unhealthy eyes, okay, if I remember when I was like my first year in the Gush, so there were a couple students who had measles, and I was going to be super tzaddik, and I went to help them and take care of them, and sure enough, I got measles, right? So for 3 weeks, I was confined to my room, and, half the time delirious. Eventually, I got better, and nobody told me that after you have measles, you have a very difficult time seeing in the light. I didn't know that. So I walked outside, they finally told me that I can go back to learning, and I still remember it. The intensity of what the sunlight did to my eyes, it was painful, right? If a person's eyes are unhealthy, if they've been in a dark cave, then the sun is actually painful, right? You can't tolerate the light. And in fact, the brighter it is, the darker it becomes for the person who can't tolerate the light. right? So what's interesting is that this is true spiritually as well, right? If a person's soul is unhealthy, then the same light that can heal a healthy person, right, actually causes the unhealthy person to suffer. You know, the best example I can think of is we were a couple years ago in the summer, we took a week and we were on vacation in Netanya, okay? And at night we walked into like the main square, you know, we were walking around, and Chaim David, who's this musician some of you may have heard of, he's unbelievable, right? He somehow had this gig, he got this gig in the summer playing for the municipality of Netanya. And, you know, I know Chaim David lives in the old city, and my kids love his music, and all of a sudden, in the middle of Netanya, there's Chaim David, couldn't believe it, right? And there's like a bunch of people, and they're bopping around in the middle of the square, it's the Jewish music, right? So for me, that was like sunlight. It was unbelievable, because you're walking through town, and, you know, some of the things you see in town, they're not so pleasant, you know, has to break your heart to see what teenagers sometimes are doing today, and all of a sudden you see Chaim David, it's unbelievable. But if somebody can't handle that music, you know, a certain type of person, he goes to a Kalbach davening, a Kalbach prayer service on a Friday night, and everybody gets into it, and they're all dancing and singing. But for him, it's agony. It's torture. And that's because his soul is in a different space. So what might cause me joy might cause him pain. Right? And you can see this. What you see, right, in terms of how you view things, is a function of how healthy your neshama, how healthy your soul is. Right? And where it's at from a spiritual perspective. So, this leads us to a couple of points. First of all, the verse, where do these rabbis get this discussion from? Why is the Midrash talking about darkness that comes from heaven or darkness that comes from hell? Simply put, says the Tiferet Shmuel, it's because of how the verse introduces the plague of darkness. The verse says, Vayet Moshe, and Moshe stretches out his hand on the sky. Anything that comes from Shamayim, comes from the heaven, must have a spiritual component, right? There must be something spiritual, something heavenly, that brought about the darkness. And that's where Rabbi Yehuda and Nechemiah don't really argue. Because you see, if the darkness comes from above, what that means is that the plague of darkness really originates from light. Moshe brings light into the world. And the reason that the Egyptians are experiencing darkness is because they can't handle that light. Right? And that's why Rabbi Yehuda says that the darkness is from heaven. Because it's light. And that's why it says that the Jews have light in their homes. Because that's what Moshe brought into the world. On the other hand, the Egyptians are experiencing darkness. Because that's the darkness that's already in their souls. Right? If you've been putting babies into mortar of pyramids, if you can throw baby boys into the Nile River, then your soul's in a dark place. And you can't handle the light, right? In fact, it's not really darkness, light and darkness that are existing side by side. In the plague of darkness, there was only light. It's just that the Egyptians saw it as dark. And that's, by the way, the essence, because one of the questions you have here is, in the Talmud, when it says that God's going to sort of bring out the sun, and the same sun will sort of reward the righteous and punish the wicked, why does it have to be the same vehicle? Why doesn't God just reward the righteous with one item, you know, the sun, and bring out lightning to make the wicked suffer? Well, what does that allegory mean? What it means is that life, the reality of life, is about recognizing that the same vehicle which produces light produces darkness. Now, if that's true, then ultimately, whether your life is full of light or full of darkness is completely dependent on where your soul is at, on how you look at it, on whether you're able to see it. I think that may be what it means, that it says, Vayet Moshe, and Moshe holds out his hands above the sky. Vayet Moshe et yado al ha-shamayim. Because really his hands are just stretched out, they're not really in the heavens. But that's a function of how you look at it. If your soul is in a spiritually healthy state, right, then every inch that's above the ground is already heaven. But if you're in a messed up place, right, then even when you look up, you're still just above ground. It's all a question of the perspective of how you choose to look at the world. And what's really interesting about this is that, you know, you always talk about sort of, or we always talk about the fact that the only real free choice that we have in this world is how we choose to look at the world. And that's definitely true. And it's true that sort of we make the choice every day in every moment as to how we choose to see life. What we don't always realize is that every time we make one of those choices, in every moment, in every instance of our lives, we're actually impacting. We're impacting ourselves. We're impacting the world around us. Every time you choose to see something as light, your soul becomes enlightened. And every time you allow yourself to see something as dark, then your soul becomes a little darker. There's another layer that sits on top of your soul. Right? At the root of it all, in our essence, we are ultimately beings of light. In fact, that's the opinion in the Garden of Eden when it says that, you know, God made for them cloaks of skin, right? Katnot or vayal bishem. He made for them cloaks of or, of skin, ayin vav resh, right? And clothed Adam and Eve after their mistake. So Rabbi Meir says, don't assume that that's cloaks of skin. It's light. Cloaks of light. Because we were originally beings of light. And therefore God has to cloak that light. Because now we're entering a world that can't handle that. Right? And ultimately, it becomes about how we choose to see the world. And, you know, we normally think of this as just like, well, I guess I get to decide. You know, I'm in a traffic jam. So do I think about the appointment that I'm missing? Or do I think about the car accident that I'm missing? You're stuck in an elevator. Do you think about, the movie you're going to miss? Or do you think about the people that Hashem just decided you're supposed to spend some time with? Right? So normally it's just about you make a decision and your life changes. What you don't realize is that every time you make such a decision, the world changes. Because you allow a little more light to come into the world. And the difference between the Egyptians and the Jews, they were in the same place. But the Jews were experiencing light and the Egyptians were experiencing darkness. By the way, this may well be how and why the Medrash says, again, you don't have to accept this literally, but there's certainly an idea behind it, that 4/5 of the Jewish people, the verse says, Chamushim alu mimitzrayim, they came out of Egypt chamushim. So some say that chamushim is from, like tachmoshet, that they were armed, they took arms with them to fight Amalek, to fight the other enemies, and some say chamushim from the word chamesh, 5. In other words, only 1/5 of the Jews came out of Egypt. So the Medrash rabbinic legend says, well, if only 1/5 came out of Egypt, where did the other 4/5 go? So they died. When did they die? They died in the plague of darkness. Which is very funny. Why did they die in the plague of darkness? Why didn't they die in the plague of the firstborn? Why didn't they die from hail? Why do you have to wait till the 9th plague? You know, so there are all sorts of discussions. You know, they had to have the chance to return, to make a difference. But this might be one way of looking at it. What really killed these Jews, again, allegorically, was how they chose to look at the world. See, there were Jews who were sacrificing the Paschal Lamb, and they were putting blood on their door jams, ready to sacrifice the God of Egypt, the Lamb. So even in Egypt, they were already free. But then there were Jews who, even if they would have gone free, they would still be slaves. So they were never really ready to leave. So they couldn't go out. And I guess that's the message of the plague of darkness, right? That darkness and light exist next to each other, and we choose which world we live in. So there's obviously a lot more to discuss on this topic. And I think, a healthy thing when you read this and you think about this, you study this, is to ask yourself, you know, how many times a day we have the opportunity to choose darkness or light, to make the world a little lighter. It's not accidental that when you go through your 6 days of the week and you're ready to transition into Shabbat, what do? You light 2 candles, right? Even though it's still daylight. Because the message of Shabbat and what the Jewish people stand for is to bring light in the world, to choose to see a different reality, to look at the world a different way. And there's so many examples of this.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.